News, sports, weather from Dr. Bill Williams, traffic info from Kane, and one of the Gulf Coast's most familiar voices. It's Mobile Mornings with Dan Brennan and Dalton Arwig.
Good morning from Dan and Dalton, 8:07 Mobile Mornings. On a Tuesday, on a pretty Tuesday as well, final day of September. Anything else we can talk about to this day? How what makes this day stand out?
Well, federal government might shut down partially tonight.
You got that.
There's that.
Let's talk about a bunch of all that stuff, including the mayor's race that the last time we talked with Quinn Hillier, that runoff day was just getting underway, and I was about to be flagged as...
inactive.
Inactive, yeah.
You're the most active person I know.
Quinn Hillier with QuinnHillier.com joins us now. Good morning, Quinn.
Good morning, Dan, you vote fraud maven, you.
I was flagged as inactive. I may have been the last example of that because I was flagged a little after 10 o'clock, and that's when they cleared up the problem. So anyway, call me, I don't know what to call me.
But anyway, the canary in the coal mine rigger, or something.
Yeah. Vote rigger Dan Brennan.
That's it. Go ahead. I'm fine with that. But anyway, the results are in. Your impression of the race, maybe the two candidates, how they poise themselves afterwards, and what's the future of Mobile under Spiro?
Well, first of all, I got to do this. A little bragging. The day after the primary, I said Spiro would probably win between 51 and 52% of the vote. I said that on TV with Peter Albrecht. I said the same thing to y'all twice on two different shows, including that morning, last Tuesday morning. And I'd said that on the air with Peter again 2 days before the runoff. All of which to say is it came down very much as I expected, which is a very close race that where Spiro's money and his endorsement from Stimson and some other factors would let him eke out a narrow victory. Mm-hmm. What that could have meant if the two candidates had conducted themselves differently, it could have meant a very tough, divisive time going forward. It, you know, a really close race sometimes leaves really hard feelings and a very disunified government and sometimes a disunified population. In this case, that is not what happened, thank goodness, and it's a credit to both candidates because they ran what, by modern standards, are remarkably positive campaigns in terms of, I mean, it's not that they offered a ton of different positive stuff, but it's that they did not go negative, they did not go nasty versus their opponents. I mean, even the one or two little things that were slightly negative were not anywhere near out of bounds. They were basic, standard political stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, and I'm sorry for the filibuster here, but when Barbara Drummond made her concession speech, she did a wonderful job. She was totally upbeat. She offered her help. She was incredibly gracious, and once she had done that, the interviews that Spiro Charagatis did afterwards were also gracious and saying that he wanted to work with her. There was absolutely no nasty, bitter sense of recrimination, and that is good for Mobile going forward.
You know, when Dan came back and he told us, you know, what had gone down when he went to vote, and he'd been listed as inactive, but they let him fill out the provisional, and then we find out, you know, we were getting texts all day from people, well, early in the morning, from people saying the same thing, and then it turns out there were a couple dozen at least that had that same issue. What we were concerned about was that it would come down to those votes because it was such a tight race throughout the day. What do you think about the increase in turnout from the general in August to the runoff? What was it, like 8,000, actually much more than that, voters that turned out that weren't there for the general? And I think West Mobile, some of those annexed portions of the county that came into the city went for Spiro, and that was a pretty big difference maker too.
It was a pretty big difference maker. I think without the annexation, we're looking at a race that would have been decided by a couple of dozen votes each way.
Hmm.
which would have been, you know, really a mess. But be that as it may, your question
with the,
was
with the turnout what? Being so much higher for the runoff.
The turnout. Yeah. It was really bizarre. The general primary, it was technically an open primary, had extraordinarily low turnout. So the runoff, it looked like high turnout, but that's only in comparison with the bizarrely low turnout in the primary.
Yeah, but why is that? Why did more people come out for the runoff than August?
Because it was a return closer to the norm. It was, believe it or not, it was still a very low turnout. It was below the norm. Here's the statistic that people should consider. When Sam Jones lost to Sandy Stimson in their first race in 2013, Sam Jones got 1,000 more votes than Spirit Share Goddess got in winning this time.
Wow.
So this was still a low turnout. You can't win with less than the loser from a previous election unless this is a low turnout, and this was low. It was just that the first one was so much lower that it made this look big, but it wasn't big. And frankly, the citizens of Mobile did not equip themselves well, because you still had a much lower than 50% way lower than 50% turnout. And for the future of the city, more people should, especially when it's the only thing on the ballot, it only takes 3 minutes in and out to go vote, maybe four. There should have been more voters than that.
Just a different kind of story that has resulted from these elections, and I want to get your take on it. With this City Council District 2, and you have Samantha Ingram, who came in and won, no runoff necessary. There were questions about her residency leading up to the vote, and then William Carroll, the now outgoing councilman, raised those again after the vote and filed, right? And he wants to fight this. Her response from her legal team was basically that state law should supersede the Zogby Act, and that state law says you need to be a lawful, I guess, resident or have home ownership in that district for 90 days prior to the election. The Zogby Act for the council seats say you have to be a resident for 12 months. Now, I think Ingram will end up winning the council seat regardless, even if they have to go back and run it back, because by November she will have, I guess, fit both parameters, the year-long residency or the 90-day. But I think legally, I mean, there's a lot of questions about the Zogby Act that are going to come up here over the next few months, it seems.
Well, okay, so when I was on before, and I've got to admit that I was wrong, I was not aware of the state law. I was citing the Zogby Act and saying that, frankly, the case against her was very strong, which it was. It was basically, it was almost a slam dunk against her. But I was not aware of that very small provision in a state law. Here's how it works. If the state law is subsequent to the Zogby Act, and if it applies statewide, then to the extent that it says something different from the Zogby Act, the state law predominates. It predominates because any time a later law duly passed comes in conflict with a previous law, the later law is what is in effect. That's just sort of normal logic, and it's also how the law works. So if that state law, which is what I think Lamiap reported, or maybe AL.com reported, if that state law came subsequent, then it does take precedence, and it's 90 days, not a year, in which case William Carroll's case goes out the window.
Wow. And do you think, because there were actually a lot of questions leading into the election about the Zogby Act, and, you know, if you're to become mayor, would you want to make any changes to the council-mayor relationship? Do you think the Zogby Act will, because of this lawsuit and this being fought out in court, see any changes, or people be more critical of the Zogby Act? Or what do you kind of see as its future? Are we just going to keep rolling along?
Well, the only part of the Zogby Act that would be negated would be the part that is indirectly in conflict with subsequent state law. And for all I know, that's only the residency requirement part. Okay. So the rest of the Zogby Act would still be in place for good or for ill. You can make really good arguments on both sides. I understand where William Carroll was coming from, especially based on the Zogby Act. She just didn't qualify. But, you know, but if that's what state law says, that's what state law says.
One more thing on the mayor's race before we hit some other stuff after the break. Do you feel like Spiro, at this point, should provide Mobile with maybe he's obligated to provide a blueprint or a vision or a plan?
Yes.
Isn't that how you get elected, by providing all that during the campaign? What is he lacking? What more do we need to hear from him before he actually rolls up the sleeves?
Well, for all the candidates in the race, you heard me repeatedly complain that they weren't being specific enough. And toward the end, his commercials sounded visionary. He had these commercials that said, "This is what I envisioned," but it was still all in the level of almost platitudes. Granted, he's only had a week, but I would have hoped we would have heard more in the last week that sounds like he was really ready to hit the ground running. Regardless, he needs to do that. When he takes office, he needs to lay out a quite specific plan of action and let people know where he's going, rather than just sort of coast in and say, well, you know, things are fine. Yeah. I mean, they might be fine. Now, I do want to say one other thing, and I hope I have time. There's a new group out in West Mobile. It's a WEMO PAC. Stephen Nodine is involved in this. Stephen Nodine has, you know, you keep hearing his name, and he always wants to do something good for the city. He didn't get to run in this time, but there is a PAC starting out there that wants to help bring West Mobile issues to the new mayor and the new council, mostly the same old council, but to the council in general, and bring those annexed areas more into the discussion, and meanwhile maybe offer some other ideas as well. So that's one other item out there.
Quickly, some state politics news too. Your thoughts on the potential of Paul Feinbaum running for Senate?
Insane. Look, Alabama needs to get serious, and this whole thing where, oh, he's something involved in football, therefore he can do anything, that's just bunkum. This is a guy who has been a radio announcer his whole career. That's what he does. And you know, radio announcers, I'm talking to two of them, can be very, very smart.
But well, thank you so much, Quinn.
But if your radio announcing is only about football, okay, then how does that translate to government? And look, I mean, it's not as if he was a very erudite, very smart talk radio guy like you guys talking about issues. This is a guy who has talked about football maybe more knowledgeably, certainly with louder opinions than anybody. But how does that translate? And do we really want a former football coach as governor and a football announcer as our U.S. senator? It's not as if he's Jack Kemp, if you all will remember,
mm-hmm. Sure.
The former congressman who spent his off season studying economics, who did an internship in the office of then Governor Reagan, who was a very good football player, but he also clearly had another background and another interest and had wrestled with public policy issues. This is a guy who's never wrestled with public policy issues in any way that anybody can know. And it's Alabama needs to start looking serious to the rest of the country. And you don't do that by just going football, football, football. And I love football, as you know. But
doesn't the job simply call for somebody to elect somebody that is popular, wins the race, and then does the Republicans voting for them? How much thought does he have to put into all that?
That's the problem. If that's all you want, then you're not doing democracy right. If that's all you want, then you might as well have a marionette up there, a puppet, or just a machine, and you punch in the answer, and the machine goes, Republican, Republican, Republican. How about it? Legislation actually takes thought and work and knowledge and the ability to work with other people, because there are different strains of Republicanism, much less different strains of Democrats. You need to know how to get legislation done. You need to know how to do a little horse trading. You certainly don't do it by spouting off about whether the Alabama football coach is an idiot or a genius.
Well, I think you're really, really minimizing Feinbaum. And sure, it's mostly football, but I'll counter. Let me just counter this. I know we have other stuff we want to get to. First off, we don't say that when a furniture salesman's running or a preacher. All he talks about is furniture. What's he going to do once he gets in front of Congress? Like, that's how this system works. And I'll say Feinbaum, I don't know anyone who works as much as he does. Now, of course, it's not hard backbreaking dig up the groundwork, but he's up early, he's up late, puts in 5 hours a day on the radio. And in that time, he talks to all kinds of people, from the PO'd Alabama fans to the coaches of the teams to political leaders. I think he has a pretty good relationship with people all over the spectrum there. And I think it's interesting if he jumps in here, because I think there's a lot more to Feinbaum than what people think just based on what they think about his show.
I will repeat, if you've got a guy in the furniture business, he's not up there talking about furniture. He's up there talking about business and about how public policy affects business. I don't see how that translates from a radio football announcer. I'm sorry.
All right, back with Quinn after this, 823 FM Talk 106.5. Good morning from Dan and Dalton and Quinn Hillier, QuinnHillier.com, NOLA, the advocate. Wednesday is Yom Kippur, if I've got
tomorrow
that right?
Tomorrow is Yom Kippur, yes. And it's the Jewish... I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I was interested. I read your article, pretty interesting. Talk about it.
Okay, so tomorrow is Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, which ends, you know, after you've gone through some self-awareness and self-criticism. It ends with a joyous sense of renewal. And meanwhile, last week I happened to speak at an event of the Mobile Jewish Christian Dialogue Group on the rise of anti-Semitism in the wake of the Hamas attacks of October 7, 3 years ago. And so I took part of that and turned it into my column. But the main theme is, anti-Semitism has been rising astronomically all across the Western world in the last 3 years, which is an outrage. And I explain why it's an outrage. But even so, there are still far more Americans who are friendly to and welcoming of Jews than there are those who are anti-Semites. But that doesn't mean that we should accept the anti-Semitism. Here are the facts. Statistics, absolutely undeniable. If you do want to look at Jews collectively, which I don't like looking at any group collectively, but the statistics show they are by far the most philanthropic group in America. They give away more money. They do more charitable work than anybody. Number two, they make better citizens. They're more civically engaged. They are not aloof and apart. They are better citizens. And there is absolutely no reason for anti-Semitism. It should have nothing to do with what you think of the Israeli government. I happen to like what they're doing, or some of what they're doing. But an individual Jew walking on the streets of Daphne is no more responsible for what Benjamin Netanyahu's government does than an individual Catholic walking on the streets of Saraland has to do with how the Pope governs Vatican City. And it's time to stop this rise in anti-Semitism, especially at the college level.
Yeah, I was going to say, mostly if you're trying to find the examples of it, it's not like the guy who's hunting out in the woods, he doesn't care. But do you have these educators and students? It's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. 34% of today's college students say things that are sort of objectively discernible as anti-Semitic. Mm. That still means two-thirds don't, but 34% is way too high.
Big number. Quinn, thanks for your time.
Happy Yom Kippur to all our Jewish friends.
Very good. We will talk again in 1 week.
Thanks.
All right, there you go, Quinn Hillier. Coming up, Brian Comer with Tobias and Comer Law. Have you ever bought tickets from Ticketmaster?
I have.
I see you nodding your head in your car. Well, federal government going after Ticketmaster and Live Nation on two fronts, really. We'll get into that and what they're being accused of and what they may have done on the way next.
Coach Orwick, we got a doozy right here. It's 8:36 on FM Talk 106.5, Mobile Mornings with Dan Brennan and, of course, Coach Dalton. And with the big win yesterday on the road.
Huge, yeah.
Brian Comer, of course, with Tobias and Comer Law. Before we get into the Ticketmaster discussion, and I don't know how many of those seats, standing room only, were purchased on Ticketmaster yesterday.
At the Bayside Sports Complex, yeah.
So I don't know if they were, they went to goteam.com or that high school.
No, what I did was I went to the front, bought all their $5 tickets, and then sold them to everybody for $7.
Nice. You could work at Ticketmaster.
Not for those numbers.
Anyway, the numbers are staggering, and I'll let you and Brian get into this whole lawsuit against Ticketmaster and Live Nation.
Yeah, and I'm glad I'm sitting between the two of you this morning, too. Let me say that. After this weekend's game, didn't want things to go awry in the studio with a Bama and a Georgia fan, but so far you both seem to be playing nice, so we'll try to keep it at that.
Yet,
so he hasn't barked yet. Bama, Georgia, Tennessee.
So, Brian, love when you come in and break down some of these big legal stories, and in the world of news like we have today, so many news items, and they usually do involve Trump on the national scene, are just things you have to talk about right now, right? And then we see some of these stories like lawsuits that they get their day in the press and then they just kind of go away for a long time. And people don't really dive into them because sometimes it's tough to look in and see what's really going on. But I texted you when I saw that the Federal Trade Commission, and I believe seven states, were suing Live Nation Ticketmaster and have accused them of, you know, illegally getting tickets to ticket brokers and, you know, being very vague about the prices that people are going to have to pay and resale. I mean, anyone who's gone and bought tickets off of Ticketmaster, you think you're going to pay a price. Then once you get to that actual checkout, you go, whoa, what are all these extra fees? Explain, if you can, what the FTC in these states, why are they suing Live Nation Ticketmaster.
I want to prepare everybody that understands Ticketmaster and Live Nation, and you just think they're all good. They're just a business. They're doing me a service. This thing is a lot scummier. This is such a level of scumbag. And then when you look at the numbers that you're producing because of these practices, my goodness, this is mafioso.
Alleged scumbags.
Yeah, well, and that's important.
These guys are scumbags.
Yeah, that's important to note. These are allegations in a complaint, which is what the federal government is alleging, along with these seven states' attorneys general, are alleging that they did. And before we really dive into it, I think just what everybody wants to hear on a Tuesday morning, a breakdown of administrative law. but it's important to understand what the FTC is. The Federal Trade Commission Commission is the U.S. government agency whose principal mission is the enforcement of non-criminal antitrust laws and the promotion of consumer protection. And so antitrust is where you prevent a monopoly, so one player in the market controlling all resources, or a collusion between two or more market players. Well, so back in the early 19-teens, 1914, the FTC Act was enacted by Congress, and it prevents unfair or deceptive acts or practices. And then there's also the Clayton Act, and Dan, this is what we were talking about before we came on the air, that it is the thing that prevents, when you have a merger like Live Nation and Ticketmaster did in 2010, you have to get government approval.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the backdrop. And so what the FTC has done is, apparently through a very, very meticulous amount of research, they file an 84-page complaint, which is the document that initiates a civil lawsuit in the Central District of California against Live Nation and Ticketmaster. And there's three main things that they're alleging, and we'll dive into these. But basically, from a big picture standpoint, one, they were deceptive in the way that they displayed prices, showing a ticket price that was not what the all-in price was, so the hidden fees. Two, claiming they're imposing strict limits on the amount of tickets that one individual or account can purchase. And then three, with those additional tickets being purchased, selling those tickets in violation of something called the Better Online Ticket Sales Act, which prohibits the practice. And so in a big picture standpoint, that's what we're talking about. But where the rubber meets the road is you're talking a bot or an account. I believe there were five, they identified in the complaint, five separate brokers that hold 6,345 accounts, bought almost 250,000 tickets. And the practical effect is when I go to buy my Paul McCartney tickets to see him in New Orleans, you're not getting the $115 face value ticket. Instead, you're getting the $500 ticket. And what you've done, Ticketmaster, as alleged in the complaint, is charging a fee on that initial purchase from the bot, and then they have to sell it on Ticketmaster's site on secondhand. So they're selling it again and charging another fee, and all that's getting passed on to the consumer.
Yeah, so they're triple dipping. Like you said, they're getting from the original purchase, from the resale, and then from the consumer who buys that final ticket. They're getting it all three ways, getting that cut. And did you put out there how much they allege to have made?
Yeah, so they break it down on the individual things, but collectively it's about $11 billion.
In B. Just from fees.
From fees, yes.
From fees, yes. From the fees. And those fees are all garbage themselves. Yes. Now, would you think that, do you think, Brian, this is just, again, you just your speculation on this. Was this a well-thought-out scheme from the beginning, or as Ticketmaster and Live Nation joined forces in 2010 and they started to see the effects of ticket selling, the bots, did they begin to harvest it all in the moment? Like, wait a minute here, we have a bigger cash flow than we ever imagined if we play it this way.
Yeah, and they actually talk about this in the complaint. It's actually a combination of the two. I mean, you had this merger, and as part of the government's approval of the merger back in 2010, they had to agree to certain restrictions that would restrict their monopolistic or unfair business practices. And as alleged in the complaint, they really set those aside. But what they were showing was, and they have specific examples with screenshots. They kept the receipts, and it shows where, say, you're going to purchase a they had a real world example. Say you're buying two concert tickets to Dan, your favorite Bad Bunny, for $245 a ticket, which would be a $490 total. Uh-huh. Well, then it doesn't display until you go to the checkout window where you have the ticker that's clicking down. You got 15 minutes to buy these tickets, or your tickets are gone, and the total's popping up at $662. $490 list price, $662
real
price. Yeah. And so they were hiding and saying, okay, well, there's $60 in taxes, but it's omitting $111 of fees per ticket, $45.20 service fee per ticket, $6 facility charge per ticket, processing fee, $8.85 per ticket. And that's on each transaction. And so,
and so
what the market data showed was, and they have receipts and emails from internal to Ticketmaster and Live Nation.
They cook themselves. If
what this is saying is true, it sure seems it, because what they're showing is they saw, hey, if we're showing what the all-in price is, the ticket sales dropped like 256%. However, if you would go to where you would have to click a drop-down menu for the additional pricing or something, then their ticket sales went up. And so they may it appears to be, based on the allegations of the complaint, a very concerted effort with real-world consequences for the consumer trying to buy, you know, concert tickets.
And real consequences for us.
Yes. Means,
but real amazing gains for them.
Absolutely.
And we're talking with Brian Comer with Tobias and Comer Law about this latest lawsuit. This is the FTC and seven states filing a lawsuit for these deceptive ticket selling practices. This is in addition to that DOJ lawsuit, that antitrust case that was filed last year, and that is regarding the Live Nation Ticketmaster kind of combination there and what they are or aren't allowed to do. So Ticketmaster, in this suit, they claim Ticketmaster handles 80% or more of major U.S. concert venues' primary ticketing. And you mentioned some of the evidence that they have here, including emails. And reading from this Ars Technica, so from 2020 to 2024, and you mentioned some of these numbers, but just one broker known to Ticketmaster, and you said there's five of the biggest brokers that control so many of these accounts, but just one of those brokers managed more than 13,000 accounts.
Yes.
So if I wanted to go, if I had a family reunion and we all wanted to go to a show and I needed to buy 30 tickets, I'd probably be limited with my one account. I don't know what their limit is, but you have these guys, these bots, these brokers who use all these different accounts to snap up all these tickets right when they go on sale. Ticketmaster, I guess, tried to break it up at one point or looked into it, and you won't believe it. They saw diminished revenue. So they said, at least according to the emails, they said one senior executive admitted in an internal email that copied Live Nation leadership, turning a blind eye to brokers quickly became a matter of policy.
Yep.
And they also allegedly decreased fees for the highest volume resellers to incentivize them to use Ticketmaster's platform.
They took it a step further, and they actually had a help desk to where you could contact them. I'm serious. You could contact them and say, well, am I going to get in trouble for buying all these? And what's alleged in the complaint is, oh, no, you're fine. We'll help you sell them.
When your organization has a help desk for scumbags, I think that makes you a scumbag.
So, and we kind of were in a similar sense, but not really. We were talking about the Google case a few years ago, and we were saying, you know, what happens? Will they have to break Google up wherever this goes? The same question is here for Ticketmaster and Live Nation. I mean, where could this go? And we were talking about it off the air, too. When the federal government brings a case like this and they have receipts, I mean, if you're handicapping the actual court battle, I mean, you'd have to put the FTC as the major favorite in this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the FTC is really the civil arm. If you think, you know, the two kind of court system branches, you've got the criminal end of things and then the civil. And so they're imposing monetary.
Like the DOJ being criminal.
The DOJ brings criminal charges. And the antitrust, the Sherman Act, which would be the collusive behavior between one entity or two with collusion.
That came around right after the Industrial Revolution was and there were so many big companies in the United States, I believe, 1914 or something?
Yeah, so the Sherman Act was 1890. Then the FTC Act was in 1914 and the Clayton Act. And so, yeah, that's where you have, you know, that was the mechanism that busted up the AT&T monopoly. And so you get the seven baby bells. You got the Alcoa was busted up, U.S. Oil, all those. And so that's the deal. Because what we want and the entire purpose of this is fairness in the market, you know. And like back in the day, dating myself here, of going and standing in line at the Civic Center to buy the tickets at 10 a.m. or whatever time they went live.
They always went, by the way, it was always 10 a.m.
And it did. And you could buy your tickets right there. And then, you know, hey, I stood in line or I camped out overnight and I got them. And now, I mean, it's a matter of seconds and they're gone. And if you're not in the queue in the right way and, you know, you don't stand a chance.
And it seems like major concerts and tours are having a renaissance. And it's been going on for several years now. This became a huge deal, I think, a couple years ago during a massive Taylor Swift tour where Ticketmaster was under the gun because, well, you don't want to make the Swifties mad.
No.
And the Swifties were logging on and trying to get tickets, but all those brokers were snapping them up. But you think back to those days where you'd get in line or, you know, we have a funny story in my family of the Kentucky Derby. I have some family up there in Kentucky and Indiana, and they would go to the Derby all the time. And my dad was there. He was probably younger than I am now with his cousin. And they had a strict rule, I guess, at the Derby, Kentucky Derby, that you couldn't resell tickets for higher than face value. Well, he had an extra ticket. And someone came to him asking him to buy his ticket and offered above face value. And he said, yeah, sure, here you go. It was a cop. He turned around and arrested him. He entrapped him right there at the Kentucky Derby. So it seems like they used to take a little bit more critical eye. And I know that was one specific event, but these monopolies have kind of just been allowed to run wild, and that's what we have here with Ticketmaster.
Well, and it's good to see this kind of thing happen, because this is what the FTC doing this is the only one that can control the market like this. And this is a deal where, you know, we want to encourage efficiency, and that's the beauty of capitalism. And you know, you create these efficiencies and you grow into this market player until you get to be too much, and then, you know, you're creating unfair practices. I mean, $11 billion in fees over a five-year period is just staggering. I mean, from 2019 to 2024, consumers spent more than $82.6 billion purchasing tickets through Ticketmaster. I mean, that's just an astounding amount of money. And, you know, so what the lawsuit is trying to do is a couple of things. One, impose something called a permanent injunction. And so that's to say, y'all can never do this again. All right. Stop the behavior, and as well as civil penalties and then monetary relief. And that's where these seven attorneys general, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Nebraska, Tennessee, Utah, Virginia.
Steve Marshall joins everything. Why didn't he join this one?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if it's – they had specific acts that this violated, okay? And so I don't know if Alabama law, it was a little bit more amorphous, or for whatever reason he didn't want to get involved with it. But these states also have claims against them in addition to the federal claims.
So I think usually, and I might be off on this, usually these end in they'll come to an agreement, right? When it's something big like this, they'll settle, I guess, is what I feel like I usually see in stories like this. But right there, you said the government has certain parameters they want to put in place for Ticketmaster going forward.
Yeah, and they could reach a deal. I mean, I think the typical statistics in litigation just as a whole is 90% of them either get resolved through motion practice, meaning that they come in, like, because we're still so early on that nothing's happened yet. They filed the complaint, they filed the lawsuit, and Ticketmaster, Live Nation have 30 days to respond after they were served. And okay. So they're going to try to have it thrown out and all that kind of stuff. But at the conclusion of all that, if that doesn't happen, the odds are it probably will settle. But if not, there'll be a trial. And
who gets the money? Settle to who?
It would go to the federal government and to the states. And that's part of its enforcement power to make sure that that doesn't happen.
But it never goes back to the consumers?
Typically, no.
Hmm.
Yeah, so you won't be getting a refund for the Cannibal Corpse tickets. So.
And by the way, they were horrible that night.
Yeah, they were opening for Bad Bunny, right?
Yeah.
Cannibal Corpse
Bad Bunny was much better.
Brian, man, thanks for breaking this down again. And I love when you come in to break down cases like this. Lord knows we'll have plenty more of them going forward. But to really look into what was going on with Ticketmaster and Live Nation, pretty astounding numbers that you laid out for us there. If people are interested in learning more about Tobias and Comer Law, I know we have our Law 251 podcast, which is available at TobiasComerLaw.com and FMTalk1065.com. But you have all kinds of great information about what you guys do there at Tobias and Comer.
Yep. Check us out on the web and the podcast. I always appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to y'all.
Absolutely. Very enlightening. In a depressing way.
Hey, good luck against that Diego Pavia this weekend, by the way.
It was a separate conversation.
What a great game that was on Saturday.
I mean, it really was.
I know Georgia lost. I get it. You know, I can read it. Scoreboard, but it was a tremendous game.
So. It was. Looked like an amazing atmosphere, too.
8:53, Dan and Dalton and FM Talk 106.5. Good morning. Good morning from Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5, Mobile Mornings. I want to go back. I guess it'll be after our show is over today. I had no idea when we were talking to Quinn, and then you just, right before the end of the first segment, you said, hey, what do you think about Feinbaum run? I didn't know that volcano was going to erupt in that way. He was like, this guy doesn't have a right to run for dog catcher.
Yeah.
But to your point.
Who does?
We should populate. Our representative should be anybody and everybody.
Yeah. And you know, I don't like debating with Quinn when Quinn's not on the air. You know, I don't even think that Feinbaum will be the kind of Republican I would normally vote for. You know, I've been listening to him for years. I never really clocked him as a Republican
in the first place.
Yeah. But to say that just because he's on the radio, and I'm not even defending us radio announcers here, to say that that would almost be disqualifying. I thought certain things about Paul Feinbaum before he was on the air here. I thought the same thing everyone else does that casually listens to the show and they happen to hear legends screaming into the microphone. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is just a bunch of dimwits yelling about football.
Like everybody on the show, including the host, is unhinged.
He's had some incredible shows where they really dive into cultural issues. Yep. And I mean, when you come on live every day and we see it, a lot of times you don't dictate what your show becomes. The what's going on in the world dictates what your show becomes.
Sometimes the callers dictate what the show becomes. Sometimes the text line or the reaction to something that you didn't think was going to be anything, and suddenly it becomes the story.
And Feinbaum, I don't know when he sleeps. He's up early in the morning on ESPN. He does 5 hours of radio, and an hour of that
exhausting
is on TV. And then after he's doing hits all day. So he's got the work ethic. He talks to the bluest of callers and bluest collar callers in Alabama. He talks to the elite, you know, Sankey. He talks to politicians. I think he's got a good grounded reality and can speak for a lot of Alabama, but a lot of people from the state. So I think he's a really interesting entrant. If he does jump in, I will say my guess would be maybe he's seriously serious about this. I think the whole Feinbaum thing, he's using it. There's drama. Why not play into it a little bit?
It's a lot like what Stephen A. Smith is doing on maybe a more national level, but with this presidential thing. No, I ain't going to do it. Well, by saying no, I ain't going to do it 100 times a day, it sounds like you don't mind talking about
thinking about it. Yeah. So it'll be really interesting to see what Feinbaum decides. Of course, there would have to be some decisions made on the broadcasting side of things, too, for him.
Including Sean would have to make some decisions.
Yeah, if it went to that level. Jeff Porcheau coming up. He'll have former State Senator Dick Brubaker on in hour number one. Paul DeMarco, the columnist, joins him in hour two. And John Wall, the GOP chairman for the state of Alabama. Texter here, the FCC. Let's see, that's Ricky. I'm just going to skip that. Rock and Roll Doctor, Ticketmaster, Live Nation isn't doing the artist any favors, screwing over their patrons at point of purchase. He also says Quinn doesn't think Paul knows business. This coming from a writer, which Paul has also been at one point in his career. High Plains Drifter said, remember when Metallica went to trial against Ticketmaster back in the day and lost? I don't remember that. I remember Metallica going up against Napster.
Yeah,
big bad Napster.
Yeah, remember that.
King of all unnamed texters. The crazy thing is that folks are still willing to pay the final price for those tickets. Yeah. Well, I think often it's mamas and daddies. Hey, you really want to go to that show. I'm going to make those tickets happen.
You might not want to once you figure out the kind of dark money that they're making.
Mm.
It's unreal.